Department of Protection for the Oregon State Legislature to order, please. Wednesday, April 11th, 2007. Got a few things to do today. We're going to start out with a motion from the good Representative Gerard.
Oh, this is going to cost you, Chair. Mr. Chair, I move the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on Senate Bill 91.
Representative Gerard moves the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on Senate Bill 91. Those of the opinion that the rules should be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on Senate Bill 91 will vote aye. Those opposed, no. The clerk will call the roll. And this week, we're starting on the left.
Aye.
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 Mr. Chair, I move.
Motion carries. The rules have been suspended.
Mr. Chair, I move we reconsider the vote by which Senate Bill 91 was sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Gerard moves that we reconsider the vote by which we sent passed Senate Bill 91. Is there any discussion? Those of the opinion.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you. I would like to hear the representative who made the motion just explain the rationale for it.
I'll take the prerogative of answering that for Representative Gerard.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Representative Gerard made that motion at my request.
Oh, thank you. Well.
Yeah. And I made that motion because there was a conflict. There needs to be a conflict amendment that wasn't caught by staff earlier. No fault of their own.
Thank you, Chair.
Those of the opinion that we should reconsider the vote by which we reconsider Senate Bill 91 will vote aye. Those opposed, no. The clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
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 Aye. The motion carries and the vote has been reconsidered.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Galizio.
On the order of where we vote, you know, I don't know how long we've been in session. It seems like a year and a half, but about a month, about 6 weeks or so, we were going this way.
Uh-huh.
And 1 week we go that way. And now we're going to go this way again?
No.
Is that the final? Is that the chair's final decision?
Well, Mr. Chair,
I like hearing Representative Riley's wisdom.
Well, this week, Representative Riley started. He complained, so I gave him a week.
Okay.
Well, I'm concerned because I usually get to be next to last, and I'm not anymore.
Well, we all have concerns. with that, I would like to open. Okay. I'd like to open a work session on House Bill 2871. And colleagues, today we're going to be taking in some amendments. We have new amendments to look at. We will not actually be moving this bill nor any of the amendments. It's not my intent to do that today. We are going to carry that over until Monday. But today I would like an opportunity for those amendments that we have been presented to be explained to this committee. And we seem to have a lot more amendments to look at than we did last time we considered this bill. So with that, and I did open the work session, correct?
You did.
With that, I would... have we got all the amendments distributed? Has everybody got the...
Dash fours?
Dash fours, dash sixes. With that, I'd like to have legal counsel come up.
I got it. It's just...
Well, they don't go together.
There's a bunch of stuff we've never seen.
Mr. Chair, can I ask one quick question just out of the game?
Group same drug.
The dash fours and the dash six, are they compatible?
I can't answer that. I have not seen the dash fours.
It doesn't look like they are.
I kind of doubt that they are.
Okay.
But I'm not going to answer that question. Thank you for coming forward. I was hoping that you would give us kind of an overview of the Dash 6 Amendment and what it does, and at some point we'll have somebody else come up and perhaps explain the Dash 4s, unless you want to stick around to answer any technical questions on that.
I'd be happy to, Chair Holby. Sean Brennan, for the record, from Legislative Council. The Dash 6s that you have in front of you are the results of some technical amendments we made to the Dash 1s, which passed earlier on this bill. What we're doing here is adding a few changes that will define who a broker or facilitator is for the purpose of conducting business, making a loan of a particular sort. The other amendments that are in the bill later will describe exactly what kinds of loans we're talking about. If we look at Section 1, we're adding the definition of broker or facilitator as a person who conducts a business in which, for a fee or consideration, the person processes, receives, or accepts for delivery to the lender an application for a consumer loan, which we define later on, and also has other duties. They accept or deliver to a lender all or most of the proceeds of a payment made in connection with a consumer loan, or assists in making a consumer loan in a capacity other than as a lender. This is intended to capture the instance where, in other states, people who've held short-term lender licenses have applied for other types of licenses, or who have formed subsidiaries to broker loans to lenders, and thereby evaded the restrictions that were placed on the licensing that was in other states to capture payday lenders, title lenders, and other short-term lenders. This is, again, aimed primarily at those folks who are what we might consider sham lenders, who are disguising themselves as different entities in order to make a loan. Later on, we have a definition. We exclude from the definition of broker or facilitator mortgage brokers and loan originators. Those are separately licensed and regulated under Chapter 59. The loan originators currently are supervised by the mortgage brokers or bankers, and the mortgage brokers themselves are licensed separately under the chapter. Consumer loan is a superset of the definitions of payday loans and title loans that are later on in Chapter 725. Plus the consumer loans that go from 60 days on up and are secured either by personal or real property or otherwise unsecured. The idea there being that we're going to capture those loans made under $50,000 that are longer than payday loan terms. In Section 2, we then also require folks who are making loans under $50,000 or who act as an agent or a broker or a facilitator, as previously defined for a person who makes a consumer loan, they will need to be licensed. Again, this is aimed at the folks who are forming subsidiaries or otherwise coming up with sham entities to try and evade the regulations we're placing on consumer lenders under this chapter. And again, we have other exclusions for folks who are not going to be required to be licensed. And those are, again, intermediaries, people who do not interact directly with borrowers or consumers, who do not collect fees or consideration for performing whatever function they perform in connection with making this loan. If they act as an intermediary between a borrower and a lender or somebody who's acting as a facilitator, or they do other ministerial type duties like transmitting information between the various entities involved here, or preparing checks and delivering them for eventual delivery to the consumer or the borrower. Then we get to the heart of what we're talking about in terms of the interest cap, which has been of some interest. And what we're doing here is, in response to various other requests that have come in, it's going to be one simple APR cap of 36%, And the 36% cap on APR is entirely consistent with what's in federal law. The Truth in Lending Act actually is a disclosure statute that talks about what borrowers are supposed to find out from their lenders. But what we're doing here is applying a cap of an APR that's determined under the disclosure laws and making sure that the cap does not go above that amount of money. And that's what the heart of, we're looking on page 2, line 30, and on page 3, lines 1 through 6. That places the APR cap on the short-term loans above 60 days. A separate cap applies to title and payday loans. That's in ORS 725, 615, and 622 for title lenders and payday lenders, respectively. We'll get to that a little bit later on in the bill. Line 7 and 8 of that are simply a conforming technical amendment to make sure that the citation we had for the Truth in Lending Act earlier in the section is repeated later on according to our form and style. The rest of that page up until about where it's line 15 is simply, that's not strictly true. The 10 and 11 are technical amendments to conform the numbering of the sections. In line 12 and 13, we're talking about giving some additional rulemaking authority to the department to specify contract forms, charges, and fees for consumer loans. If, for example, the department wanted to specify a standard contract form, they can do that under this amendment. And they can also specify particular charges and fees by rule. And that applies to consumer loans, which again is payday loans, title loans, and loans above 60 days. In 610, we're just simply adding the ORS 725-610, we're adding the broker to the existing statute that allows for facilitators and agents to be licensed in accordance with that chapter for payday lenders, for title lenders, I think, in that particular case. And then in Section 9, we're simply doing a technical amendment to conform the fact that we're deleting some of the rulemaking authority in the chapter under 725-625, and making our sole rulemaking provision in this chapter 725-505. And so that's a conforming amendment there. That extends on to page 4. And then the remainder of that is really just applicability provisions. It makes the act actually start along with all the other acts related to payday lending, title lending, and consumer lending on July 1st of this year. I'd be happy to entertain questions.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Chair Hovey. Thank you, Mr. Brennan, for explaining the Dash 6 amendments. Some of the concerns that were raised under the prior version was that there wasn't flexibility, for example, for a borrower to maybe pay points to buy down the interest rate, and there wasn't enough, because the fee was capped before, that fee wasn't enough to allow for sufficient underwriting. Will this amendment address those two issues?
Chair Hovey, Representative Bonamici, it should. Again, we're rolling everything of all the fees that you could possibly use to buy down the interest rate or other fees that are associated with the finance charge are allowed under this particular cap to be rolled into the APR in accordance with federal law on the disclosure aspect of that. That disclosure aspect is now, through this amendment, operating as a cap and allowing a lender to roll in fees or any other kinds of charges that are allowable under that disclosure provision into their interest rate or into the finance charge they charge for the loan.
Follow-up? Thank you, Mr. Chair. And there was also a concern expressed that by the limitations in the prior version that a lender wouldn't be able to charge, for example, late fees or NSF or collection costs. Will that be addressed in this amendment as well?
This amendment is silent as to giving particular permission to do that, but there's no real restriction on that. The restriction that would be allowed would be the restriction that would be in federal law with regard to how the Truth in Lending Act rolls in the various fees to the annual percentage rate. That annual percentage rate calculation does not include those types of fees in the APR, so those fees would not be capped by this provision.
Thank you.
Thank you. Further questions? Representative Girard.
Thank you, Chair. The question I have is, we've already passed out of this legislative body HB 2202, 2203, 2204, and 2205, which dealt with payday loans, title loans, et cetera. Are the bills compatible?
Chair Hovey, Representative Girard. Yes, in fact, they are. I've gone over them. There are some provisions in here where one or another version of the language will need to prevail. There will be some conformance needed between certain of those bills. That is true. In particular, the rulemaking function that's in HB 2205 for the department, one or the another of those formulations between this bill and that bill will need to prevail, and that may need to be done in either body in order to conform those particular amendments. There also is some redundancy between certain of the bills as well with regard to this bill and, for example, House Bill 2204, which has certain provisions related to title lenders and the caps that they're placed on them. There is no actual cap in House Bill 2204 for the fees charged. There is a $10 per 100 fee allowed under 2204, but it's not capped at $30 as it is in 2871. So there is a slight conflict there as well, in the sense that there would be a cap placed on that. As I understand that the impetus for this bill in the first place was to introduce such a cap.
Follow up, please.
This
is a little different section, and it's the original bill, page 5, lines 16 through 21, where it told how they could recover the money for a faulty. And I thought that was to be amended, and I don't see it in your amendment.
I'm sorry, could you repeat that citation?
On the original bill, page 5, mm-hmm. lines 16 through 21.
Yes. That language also, I believe, is in House Bill 2204, I think.
I really have an exception to the language that's in there, because if they get a dishonored check, they can't recover statutory damages or attorney fees.
Vice Chair Bonamici, Representative Girard, that is true in that language. Well, the attorney's fees are a separate provision, I believe. With regard to dishonored check, that is true. There is a cap on there, and I think the intent there was to make sure that payday lenders or title lenders who have, actually I guess it would be payday lenders primarily in this instance, who hold a check as security for the loan or as the instrument by which it's paid, if the amount of funding is not there at the time the check is actually submitted or presented for payment, then they will get an NSF. The borrower will get an NSF fee from their bank. The practice has been that many of these title lenders or payday lenders have been submitting that check repeatedly, knowing, in fact, that there were insufficient funds there. I think that provision was meant to restrict or keep that practice from happening.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
But this is all encompassing. This isn't for top. This is for consumer loans in the whole nine yards here. So, if they get an NSF check, what prevents somebody from just repeatedly writing NSF checks and not face any attorney fees or statutory damage?
Vice Chair Nelson, Representative Girard, this particular provision in line 16 through 21 of page 5 is directed to title lenders. And there is no analogous provision at the moment for consumer lenders in this bill.
Representative Nelson?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Brennan, I should probably address the chair, but since we've had so many changes to this bill, it's apparent to me that, we need some dissecting, an outline now, totally, of what we are, requiring and not requiring in each one of these categories. Is it possible you could do that and get it to us pretty quickly?
Chair Holvey, Representative Nelson, I think I can certainly do that. Are you talking about what this bill in particular does or what the package of bills related to title lending
and so
forth?
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Representative Nelson.
If you start with this one, I'd be grateful because, and I've had, and maybe like the others, I've had so much input from so many people that, almost to be able to check each one of them off and say, yes, this is true, and no, it isn't. I'm just hoping that we could do that. Well, certainly before we vote.
Well, thank you, Representative Nelson, and that's why, we're not moving this bill today, is I want the committee to have time to take a look at this and be a little more assured of what we're voting on today.
or Monday, as it would be. Any other questions of Mr. Brennan on this particular amendment? Mr. Brennan, thank you very much for walking through this and your work on this. Next up, I think we have, what's the other amendment, Dash 4 amendment? Okay. And the proponent of the Dash 4 amendment, I'm told, is Mr. Cosgrove. So if you would like to give us your rendition of the Dash 4 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And Mr. Brennan, if you could stay in case we have a technical question, that would be might be helpful for us, too.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Paul Cosgrove, representing the Oregon Financial Services Association. We have proposed the Dash 4 amendment, and I will briefly describe its what it does, and then be happy to do a line-by-line as people desire or answer specific questions as people desire. The Dash 4 amendment does not include a rate or fee cap, but in lieu thereof, it has a number of restrictions on lending practices that we believe address, and they're intended to address, and we believe do address all of the potential loopholes that have been identified, which would allow payday lenders or title lenders to get away from the restrictions in their own statutes and continue to operate under a general traditional consumer finance license. And those are, just briefly, a requirement for loan terms of 6 months or more for nearly all loans, a requirement for loan underwriting, a defined term with specific requirements, a requirement for loan amortization with a few exceptions, and in addition to that, a couple of particular provisions that are new that you have never seen before in any other of these amendments, and I'll highlight them for you on page 6, lines 4 through 6, there was some concern that open-end loan plans or open-end credit card plans might be a means for a payday lender to evade restrictions of the payday loan statute and use the general consumer finance open-end loan plan. And we've added words, a licensee may not disguise a loan as an open-end loan plan as a device, subterfuge, or pretense to evade the requirements of this chapter. And there's a similar insertion under the other section for open-end credit card plans. Finally, and perhaps most importantly, if you look on page 7, there is a provision in a new section 14 that is based on both law that is currently in place in Nevada and law as it is proposed to be amended in Nevada that provides that no person, and it's a very broad section applying to any kind of person, whether it be a broker, agent, facilitator, or any other kind of person that seeks to evade the applications of these statutes by any device, subterfuge, or pretense, and then it goes on to list some of them, but it has the preceding language of including but not limited to calling a loan by any other name, using an agent, affiliate, or subsidiary in an attempt to avoid the application of the provisions of these statutes, or becoming affiliated with or entering into a business arrangement with any entity or an entity, but obviously not limited to any kind of entity that is not subject to the law, where there's a sharing of the fees or the revenues. In other words, the kind of discussion about a concern that evidently was occurring in the state of Texas. So that's what the Dash 4s are. I'd be happy to answer any questions or go into more detail as the committee chooses.
Just to clarify what I heard, so there is no interest rate cap involved in the Dash 4 amendment?
That is correct, Mr. Chair, and I should say there is no interest rate cap for traditional consumer finance. It does not change the provisions in Sections 5 and 6 of the base bill that both continue and change the interest and fee cap on title and payday loans. But with respect to traditional consumer finance companies, you're exactly correct.
Thank you. Questions of Mr. Cosgrove? Representative Nelson, would you like to go first?
Oh, sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just, probably is in here somewhere, but traditional is defined in the ORS as somewhere traditional. loans. If not, could we get one, a definition?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nelson, it is a shorthand way that I am using for a definition that is contained in the law as amended by this bill, and I'll give you what the definition is. The definition is it is a lender who is making loans under $50,000 to consumers that is not a payday loan and not a title loan as defined in the statute. And as you may recall, the payday loan is loans that are less than 60 days with a post-dated check. And a title loan is the kind of thing that you think of as a title loan. The definition is in the statute. All other loans made by a lender who has a license under this statute is what I'm calling traditional consumer finance, because those folks are people who do not make payday or title loans. Does that answer your question?
Yes, and follow up,
please.
Maybe we need to include that in this document.
It is once I think you get, Mr. Chairman, Representative Nelson, once I think you get the piece of paper that Legislative Council is going to give you, which combines the amendment and the bill, I think you'll see that it is defined.
Okay.
It's now in several pieces of paper.
Okay.
Representative Girard, a question?
Thank you, Chair Holby. I think in Section 3, the definition is a little bit there. By 90% or more of the loans made by the consumer finance licensee have a term of not less than 6 months. So, I like these amendments a lot better than I do the original bill.
We're happy for that.
Mr. Chairman, I'm happy.
That was
that
your whole purpose. Your dream.
Representative Galizio, question?
Yes, Mr. Cosgrove, if the dash 4 and the dash 6 are mutually exclusive in your mind, is that an acceptable premise?
Chairman, Representative Galizio, they are both, I think, inconsistent in a legal sense or a legislative council sense, but they are also inconsistent from a policy sense.
Okay,
yes.
So why would the dash 4 be better public policy?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Galizio, there are several answers to that question. One is, I think that the problem has described to this committee and other committees in this body over the special session and the prior part of this session were problems with respect to payday and title lending, which everybody agreed was defined by definition predatory lending, and that restrictions were necessary on traditional consumer finance lenders pretty much solely for the purpose of making sure that it didn't become a home for people migrating to a license to continue their business under another way. This, I think, accomplishes that purpose without putting unnecessary restrictions on the consumer finance industry.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Cosgrove, in our earlier public hearing on this bill, I tried to get a sense of how many consumer finance lenders charge interest rates or annual percentage rates above 36%. And at one point you said maybe a few, and at one point you said maybe none. And I actually spent a little bit of time playing with an APR calculator over the weekend, for which I got a serious flack from people on this committee. But the concern that I have is that you are... The purpose of the rate cap is to try to prevent predatory lenders from finding a way to get around it, and we believe that the 36% was more than adequate. And with the changes in the dash 6, it allows the flexibility without the fee cap. And I know that in some of our research, we found that in North Carolina, for example, with a 36% APR, the small lenders, small loans business was thriving. And 36% is pretty high. And so I'm just trying to get a sense of how this would, in your opinion, affect your industry, a 36% APR cap, because that's you can charge a lot of interest and a lot of fees even under that 36% APR.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bonamici, first of all, just to clarify what I said before, what I thought I said and intended to say is it may be a different answer if you're asking about an interest rate cap than an APR cap. I do not know of any of our members at the moment who are charging more. In fact, most are charging significantly less than 36% as an interest cap. Some may be charging some borrowers on some loans more than 36% as an annual percentage rate. And at other times when interest rates are higher, that number might grow. So I just want to make sure that's clear for the record. The traditional limitation in most states that I'm aware of around the country is not an APR cap, it is an interest rate cap. And the reason for that, at least in part, is that things like mortgage broker fees and other kinds of loan broker fees that we've discussed that are now relatively well handled in these sets of amendments are generally included in an APR, even though they have nothing to do with interest and they're not even going to the same entity, the same company. It is not uncommon around the country, to my understanding, to have 30% interest rate caps, but generally speaking, there are not the kind of severe restrictions on fees that are in this bill. I'd point out that even under the Dash 4, I have a concern, and the attorneys that I'm talking to who have reviewed this issue have concern that it still isn't clear that there's any legal authority for a traditional consumer finance lender to charge a late charge or things that are not part of the APR cap, because this bill, even as amended by the Dash 6, deletes the section under which we charge for appraisals, title reports, all sorts of things that have nothing to do with interest or APR, but that section of the law is deleted in the base bill and under the Dash 6. So that's a concern we have. I'd just also point out that, ironically, the proposed APR cap in this bill is a lot less than the APR cap in the Payday and Title Lending bill you just passed out. Seems sort of ironic, but it is. It's significantly less. I think the data before you in the title and payday lending is, although the interest rate cap was 36%, once the fees were calculated in on short-term small loans, those APRs might be well over 100%.
Follow up. And that's because those are for very short-term. And,
correct.
And I just want to remind everybody that this bill applies to loans that are under $50,000. It's not applying to home loans or larger amounts.
And if I just may say one other thing, Mr. Chairman, there is still a concern on a number of my members who primarily do mortgage loans, some of which are done under the purposes of this chapter, is that we're not sure yet how we fixed the mortgage broker issue in the Dash 6s. It still is difficult to see how this works in a mortgage lending context, and that's something that I don't think anyone intended to affect in this bill. In fact, the testimony of some of the advocates at the hearing was this doesn't affect mortgage lending, and we'd be certainly much more comfortable if this did not have any effect on mortgage lending.
Further questions of Mr. Cosgrove? Representative Nelson.
Yes, sir. Thank you. Paul, I thought one of the issues for this amendment was the fact that we have second mortgages on real estate that are included in this scenario.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nelson, some second mortgage loans made by my members who are licensed under Chapter 725 that are under $50,000 are made under this license, and as such they would be governed by whatever restrictions you include in this bill. Generally speaking, if my members make first mortgage loans, they are not governed by these restrictions. But seconds, many seconds are, including home equity lines of credit, for example, under $50,000.
Any questions? Thank you, Mr. Cosgrove. I appreciate it.
And thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Brennan, do you wish to make any more comments about anything you heard here about the Dash 4 amendments to help clarify anything?
Not so far, Chair.
Thank you. Seeing no further discussion, Steve, do we have any other amendments that I am or am not aware of on this bill? Okay, with that, I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2871. And again, I will be carrying that bill over till Monday, is it correct? Monday we'll be working this bill. With that, I would like to open a public hearing on House Bill 2781. Steve, give us a brief summary of House Bill 2781.
Thank you, Chair Holby. House Bill 2781 requires the Director of DCBS, Department of Consumer and Business Services, to appoint a Construction Contractors Insurance Advisory Committee. You have dash one amendments before you, and this bill, if passed in its original form, would have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. However, if we do adopt the amendments, there's also a letter on your desk that would rescind the subsequent referral because we've been informed by Legislative Fiscal Office that there wouldn't be a fiscal impact if we adopt the dash one amendment.
So do we have the approval to rescind that? Thank you. And it'd be nice to have somebody from the Department of Consumer and Business Services to come up and talk to us about this bill.
And here's one. Grab
it. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Joel Lario. I'm the Administrator of the Insurance Division within the Department of Consumer and Business Services. We're here today in support of the dash one amendments to 2781, which is very similar to the original bill in the substance, but it just eliminates some of the process issues that were included in the original bill and kind of cuts to the chase and says that the director has the authority to determine what kind of data could be collected to help address and understand questions of affordability and availability, and also understand how construction defects contribute to some of the insurance problems in the contractor liability marketplace. And so we support those amendments, think that they speak directly to the issues that we would like to resolve. I'd make two other general comments here. One is that we have been ourselves frustrated with the inability to get the kind of data that we would like to get on the submarket, and we've talked about that here before, how this is a difficult issue for us, and it's also a difficult issue for the insurers, because we're talking about a submarket within a broader category of insurance, and so a lot of the data issues aren't uniform across carriers, and so that creates some difficulty here. But the bottom line from our perspective is that carriers still have to have a database that they can use when they're deciding what to charge as a rate to a specific customer, and so these questions have to be answered in some form or fashion each time they decide how to rate an individual customer, and we would like to get more close to understanding how that data works. The second general comment is that I'm not sure we will get there. We've tried a lot of different approaches to this, and we're currently trying to work with some of the national rate-making organizations to see if we can get better data handled there, because the way in which this market works, some of the data is, the initial data points are set through national rate-making organizations, but then the carriers in Oregon use their Oregon experience to adapt, modify off of that national data. So we're trying to approach it from the national rate-making side, too. So can't promise that this bill would produce a result, but I think it's a reasonable expectation for you as a legislature, and I feel like it's a reasonable expectation for us at DCBS to expect to get more accurate data on some of these very intractable problems, and we think this bill is at least a promising approach to that. With that, I'd stop and be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Representative Nelson.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. In fact, I have several. Joel, first of all, you know, I thought during the interim that there was a mutual desire to have one committee that would go forth with this rather than, you know, the department deciding what data was to be required, and I'm wondering what really took us away from that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, again, I don't think we really are away from that. The way the dash ones are constructed, it directs our department through the director to determine what kind of data can be collected. But to do that by rulemaking and in our normal rulemaking procedures, we would have an advisory committee that would involve all the interested parties. So that still is the approach we use here, but rather than create another statutory advisory committee that potentially has a life beyond the specific needs of this bill, we simply made it a normal rulemaking process in which we would incorporate an advisory committee.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up, Representative Nelson.
I guess maybe you could just address these points. I have five of them. First of all, insurers keep various types of data and various types of programs. And so having specific data requirements might not be so helpful then, and would likely involve a lot of program and expense and systems revisions that would be costly to the companies and therefore to the customers. That's one. Secondly is many contractors are insured by carriers outside of the regulated market in the surplus lines market. And without requiring those insurers to participate, the data is going to be, you know, really uninformative and misleading. And it really is unlikely that the department would have the authority to require the surplus lines to participate since they're not regulated. And thirdly, the cost of collecting this data is very expensive and burdensome on small companies, one of which I have in my district that's very important to us. What these domestic insurers really need is resources and programming time dedicated to and focused on issues which improve their service to agents and policyholders, not on data collection that serves really no useful purpose. And fourthly, the collection of historical data, as mandated in the bill, could lead to erroneous conclusions about the current market conditions and focus policymakers on ineffective solutions. And lastly, the third section of the bill, Section 3.1b, requires the department to assess how effective the task force recommendations were when, in fact, the legislature is determining how those recommendations would be made law, and certainly not all the recommendations will be adopted. So I guess with my constituent, I'm feeling that this proposal will probably likely not solve an existing problem as contractors' insurance is available and affordable given the potential exposure. And basically, lastly, legislation should focus on preventing construction defects and litigation arising from those defects.
Good stuff. Thank you for that testimony, Representative Nelson. Joel, do you care to respond to that?
Mr. Chair, yes, I'll respond. I think they are good questions. The first one, that the collection of the data may be costly, that is always taken into account in our rulemaking procedures. There are even specific requirements on us to look at the cost-benefit of imposing different obligations on carriers, and we're always very sensitive, particularly to our domestic carriers and smaller domestic carriers, even more so about these issues. So all of that would be taken into account by us in terms of how we developed a solution, and the fact that we may figure out in theory some data that would be incredibly useful to have, but it may turn out to be incredibly expensive to gain. That's one of the reasons I said I don't want to promise an easy resolution. I can't promise that this bill will produce the right result because it may turn out to be too costly. Even if we figured out how to get the data, it may turn out to be very costly to get it because it's not collected currently in the form and fashion that we would like it to be. Secondly, on the surplus lines issue, you're right. Right now, there's a question about our authority to collect data there, but this legislature has the power to give us that authority, and this bill, in express terms, gives it to us. So if this bill passes, services, we have the authority to go to surplus lines and collect the data from surplus lines. I already addressed the issue of burdensome on small insurers, that the historical data may not be predictable. That's absolutely right as well, and that would be a factor that we would have to consider, and it may be that we would resolve this in favor of data on a prospective basis rather than data on a historical basis. That would, in general terms, make the cost much more manageable. If you're telling people to go back and redo data sets that are already done one way, that's usually a more costly proposal than asking people on a go-forward basis to collect certain data in certain ways. And then at the end, I don't believe the language is any longer in the bill. I was just looking to say that we're using this data primarily for the two purposes that are articulated in Big A and Big B in lines 8 to 12, which is related to the availability and affordability of the insurance, and related to how construction defects affect the market. Those are the two dominant purposes that are stated in this amendment. So some of that language from the prior bill about measuring the effectiveness or ineffectiveness of various reforms is not in this draft, unless I'm missing something. And then the final point on prevention, we couldn't agree more, and that's why we've thought it's very important that the result of the task force was primarily, not exclusively, but primarily oriented towards actions that can be taken by the construction industry, by the contractors board, to better train, equip, continue to monitor the effectiveness of building practices so that the problems can be prevented in the future. But I also think the legislature has quite properly said this is not exclusively a problem of bad practices in the market. We also think there may be dimensions of this problem that relate to how the insurance industry sets rates and so forth, and I think that's right. It's a secondary issue to us, but it is a issue, and so we think collecting this data may be a complement to the many important preventive activities that I believe this committee is going to spend most of this hearing talking about today.
Thank you. Any other questions of Mr. Aereo? Representative Gerard.
It took me a while, and thanks to Representative Bonamici to help me here. This is basically a gut and stuff of this bill. We're deleting sections 2 and 3, and we're inserting this little piece here for section 2. There were some concerns by some of the insurance companies concerning various aspects of the original bill. Do you know, were those addressed, Jack Monroe specifically?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gerard, some of them were addressed in the way that the bill now focuses very specifically on just those two purposes, availability and affordability, and the role of construction defects in the market. But I believe you'll hear testimony subsequent to this saying that those were the more minor concerns and that the more major concerns are not addressed because of the Representative Nelson's questions, I think, illustrate well some of the concerns that the industry still has. So I don't expect that you'll have insurance industry support for this bill. We've worked hard to try to find a ground of agreement on this, and we have it. So I like to come here with agreement with the industry, but on this one, we don't have it.
Any further questions? Seeing none, I'd like to close the public. Do we have anybody else signed up for this one? I'll close the public hearing for House Bill 2781. With that, I'd like to open a work session on House Bill 2781.
Mr. Chair, I move that we adopt the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2781.
Representative Bonamici moves the adoption of the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2781. Any discussion? Any objection?
That we have a vote? Or that we adopt that amendment?
This is on the adoption of the amendment.
Mr. Chair, I will be a no vote.
Okay. This is on the adoption of the amendment.
Right.
Do you have an objection to the...
Yes, I do.
Representative Nelson objects. So, with that, the Dash 1 amendments are adopted. Representative Bonamici.
Mr. Chair, I move that we send House Bill 2781 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Bonamici moves House Bill 2781 to the floor, as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay.
Okay, thanks. May we have the roll, please?
No.
Aye.
Aye. No.
No.
Aye. House Bill 2781, having received the required votes, is declared passed.
As amended.
As amended, it is declared passed. A volunteer to carry that bill on the floor? Looks like the chair will carry that bill. With that, I would... coming up next here. I'd like to open a public hearing on House Bill 2108. Steve, give us a brief review of 2108, please.
Thank you, Chair Holby. House Bill 2108, at least as originally written, requires construction contractors and owners and officers of a construction contractor to notify the CCB within 30 days after filing a petition in bankruptcy court, and it is being amended to deal with concerns relating to stucco and EPIS and construction materials.
Thank you. We could have, looks like it is a construction contractor board bill, or is it a task force bill? Or both?
Yes.
Maybe both of you could come up.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Mark Long. I'm Administrator of State Building Codes and staff for the Construction Claims Task Force. I did pass out, just for the committee's purview, kind of an overview of the pieces of legislation that we've been discussing since we've last been in front of you, probably 2 or 3 weeks from ago. And House Bill 2108-1 is a gut and stuff. It is a complete replacement of the bill with this language. And as part of the discussions among various folks that are interested in the range of construction defect issues, there was a Senate bill introduced, obviously on the Senate side, that would have prohibited synthetic stucco, and it was suggested that we put that in this package that we've been discussing with the contractors and others over here on the House side. So we've done that. What this bill does is prohibit a licensed contractor from installing synthetic stucco. Some of you may be familiar with it, the generic term EIFS, or heard about EIFS product. That is the synthetic product that has been discussed by both consumers, builders, installers, the task force, and others with some concern. I think the language more or less speaks for itself, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
I do have one question. Have you had any discussion or communication from industry on this particular product and the construction industry that installs this product as a general rule?
Mr. Chair.
You know, to either one of you.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, there has been discussion. I can tell you that the task force itself looked at the issue of synthetic stucco and had testimony regarding synthetic stucco and other products and determined it was didn't make a determination or recommendation to the legislature to prohibit the product. Other folks that are in the industry believe that the product should be prohibited because what happens, typically, not all the time, but typically through the insurance policies, this product is excluded and therefore you don't have coverage when you use the product, and then that can potentially, not saying all the time, can potentially leave the contractor or the consumer in a kind of an awkward position where they've used a product that they don't get coverage for. As far as feedback from the contractors, I haven't had anything specific. I know working with some of the general contractors and the subcontractors, they're checking into whether or not they would have concerns, and they haven't had an opportunity to get back to me on this. I need to be quite candid with you, Mr. Chair. I've heard all sides of this issue, both at the task force level and over here at the legislature. But again, this was a bill that was similar format proposed on the Senate side, and the thought being that we would get all these kind of consumer protection related issues in one piece. And so we brought it over here for your consideration as part of this overall package of things we're attempting to do. Hope I answered your question.
Mr. Smith, can you shed any more information on this subject?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Craig Smith. I'm with the Construction Contractors Board. This is, as you know, neither a task force bill nor a Construction Contractors Board bill. I can tell you that I have heard from proponents of this position, feel very strongly about it. There's no question that this particular building product or products like this have caused some concern in this part of the country. And unfortunately, I have to report to you, I've heard from manufacturers who have a different opinion. And so the board has not taken a position regarding this particular product. I think the amendment does speak for itself, and I wish I could give you some more wisdom. I'm without that at the moment.
Well, in your capacity at the Construction Contractors Board, you received complaints on this product, and has it been your experience that the insurance doesn't cover the damages, or do you have any knowledge of that as far as insurance companies not really covering the product failure?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I can tell you that we have received a few complaints about EIFS where we stand, because we receive complaints regarding residential structures. A lot of this product is put on commercial structures, and those types of disputes are resolved through the court systems or arbitration, and I'm not privy to those matters. Again, I can tell you that as far as insurance coverage, we do not see the exclusions that are on various contractors' insurance policies. We don't get every policy, but I understand that in many cases this particular product is excluded, so that it's not covered if contractors do install it. And I can tell you that in many cases contractors have reported to the board and to me that it is problems with this particular product that have driven insurance rates higher. That's their perception.
And a final question, does this bill cover both residential and commercial construction?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Yes.
Thank you. Any other questions from the committee? Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you just give me an example of another product that you might prohibit or have prohibited?
I'll start out, if I can, Chair and Representative Gilliam. There is no similar legislation or statute in the Construction Contractors Board law, so this would be a first. With regard to building codes, let Mark talk about that.
Chair, I'm not, Representative Gilliam, I'm not aware. And I can tell you that, again, it was discussed at the Construction Claims Task Force, where we had quite a bit of testimony. In fact, some of the folks that install as well as manufacture the product came out. I can tell you anecdotally, we were told, I believe one other state prohibits it, but off the top of my head, I do not remember which one it was. This was some time ago. Again, this is something that's been discussed by members of the legislature and other folks, and again, we brought this forward just for your consideration.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm trying to get a sense of where this came from and who's the proponent, because it's it's a pretty big step to just say you can't use this product anymore. And I wonder if you could tell us a little bit more about the history, please.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bonamici, I was just asking Mr. Smith if he remembered the individual Senate bill that was on the Senate side that introduced this and the various sponsors, and I don't off the top of my head. I'm sure I have it in my briefcase full of all of my construction claims task force information. but there was a specific bill, again, on the Senate side that was introduced to, as well as a couple other items, prohibit synthetic stucco, and in just discussion we thought we would bring it to this committee. We thought this was the proper committee to look at these range of issues, and that's how it got here. Again, the task force looked at it and did not take an action one way or the other. We got comments on all sides of the equation about whether it was the product, whether it was a product problem or whether it was an installation problem, and then how that related to insurance. So apologize for kind of being vague here, but there isn't a lot of concrete positions on this one way or the other. I can tell you, though, some members in the legislature in this building feel pretty strongly about prohibiting this product, and we said, well, we'll bring it forward.
Follow up, please. Not necessarily to you, but is there anybody else going to testify about this today?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
So, and I guess I lied, or I misspoke. I do have another question. So without this amendment, this bill still accomplishes some of our goals around the Construction Contractors Task Force?
Mr. Chair, 2108 was simply a vehicle to bring this issue forward to you.
And so that's all this amendment does?
That's okay. Correct.
All right. Thank you. That's answers my question. Next up, I'd like to have, I think it's Larry White or Larry Witz. Larry White, I think.
Thank you, Chair Holvey and members of the committee. I actually came to speak on another bill. And
I'm glad you're here.
To your comments, talking about a contractor and an applicator, which I happen to be. I'm the plaster division manager for Western Partitions, a large subcontractor. We do steel studs, drywall, plaster. I manage the plaster portion. I've been installing EIFS since its inception in the 80s. I can testify that it has gone through a lot of changes, and the insurance companies are, you know, right now either excluding it or you have to get a second line specific coverages. But it is opening up. And the insurance carriers, such as Zurich, are starting to move toward bringing it back in because the industry's got a lot of changes. There are buildings that I worked on in Portland and the metro area in the mid-'80s that have EIFS on them today that have not had problems, are still viable. When the industry first took off, it was kind of cheap and easy to apply, and the manufacturers did a poor job of regulating it. And they ended up with a bunch of people that were really not qualified, and then we got in this whole mess. And they've done a better job now of having qualified people and trained people. And I think that's part of the building envelope, which is another issue we're going to be getting to. You know, it doesn't matter what cladding you put on the wall, whether it's brick or EIFS or whatever. If it's done improperly, there's a chance for failure. I've seen metal panel systems fail. I've seen brick systems fail. You know, it just comes back to having the qualified, trained personnel that are working on these building envelopes. And so these guys, you know, I think banning a total product is just hurts our industry, you know, and the definition. We've done a lot of projects with stucco where we use EIFS type applications for cornices and architectural details. And if you broad stroke it, you know, it's going to change our industry a lot, and you're not going to get the design and the appeal to the buildings out there, and it can be done right. Like I say, I've seen it, I've done it. You know, wood frame structures.
Mr. White, have you seen the Dash 1 amendment that actually does this?
I actually haven't seen the amendment.
You might come forward and take a look at it. Maybe a little out of order, but I'm a chair, I can do that.
Mr. Chair, can I ask a question, please?
You bet.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Bonamici.
Mr. White, I'm going to ask for a translation. You're talking about EIFS. Is that a brand name or an acronym or what? Because it's not in the the Dash One amendments, and I thought Representative Gilliam might want to know.
Thank you, Representative Bonamici. EIFS stands for Exterior Insulated Finish System.
Yeah.
And it's become kind of the nomenclature for the design, and you hear the word synthetic stucco. It's actually quite different than stucco. Stucco is a traditional cement plaster system with a wire lath, and this has a foam with an acrylic-based cement reinforced over the top with a finish. Now, both of them have a vapor barrier system, which is the main part of the building envelope. So the the EIFS systems back in the 80s and 90s, a lot of them were barrier systems, so they didn't have a weatherproof membrane in the building envelope, and the exterior of the system was actually what was keeping the water intrusion out. Today's EIFS systems actually use a waterproof membrane behind the system as a primary barrier, and then you have a secondary barrier, and they usually have a drainage plane in between. So they actually have, you know, they have improved the systems. They're trying to get rid of these defects. I mean, I think we all in the construction industry are trying to get rid of these defects. And as for the insurance issue part of it, our company did an EIFS system on the Wapato Jail, and we didn't have EIFS coverage, and we actually bought a policy with a 10-year tail to actually cover that specific project. On a large project like that, it's possible to do that. And you know, on small projects, it's really not affordable. But the insurance industry, like I say, is changing, and we're seeing more and more offerings for more affordable insurance for EIFS projects.
Thank you.
Well, thank you for your testimony. I'll give you a chance to look at that Dash 1 amendment. And I guess from your, are there any other questions of Mr. White? Just curious, how do you train your people to do this correctly, if that seems to be the issue?
Chair Holvey, we, you know, a lot of people go through an apprenticeship program. Not all companies have that. We're actually a union contractor, so our guys get, you know, real good basic training. But the real training's on site, and so it comes from the experience. So when we set up our programs for each job we do, we go through the details and the waterproofing envelope design, and then we actually have an inspection program where we go through on a daily basis and make sure every I is dotted and T's crossed in the installation process. You know, it's just experience and making sure we've got good supervision, and they do go through different classes, and our people in Seattle are going through a actual building envelope training right now for kind of a certification up there. So,
thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gilliam.
You were probably lobbied heavily by the EIFS lobby on this, like I was. But
actually, no.
I'm interested to know what more about the motivation on the Senate side, but with this kind of strange situation of picking on one product, maybe there's a way in the training bill to just make a practical recommendation or reference to this product to be specifically covered in the training, so that we don't deal with it in this format as a separate bill. I hate this product. I have this product on my house, but it was installed, and it wasn't me, by an untrained inferior installer, and it is a problem. But I'm encouraged by the fact, you know, what we're hearing here.
I was doing the best I could.
See, I tried to protect you. So that's my comment.
Okay, I appreciate your testimony on this today. I really do. I'm glad you were here. With that,
thank you.
I'm going to close the hearing on House Bill 2108, and we'd like to open a hearing on House Bill 2654. Steve, give us a little preview of that bill.
Thank you, Chair Holvey. House Bill 2654 requires a construction contractor to maintain insurance that provides the contractor with liability coverage for completed work.
Okay. Thank you, Steve. And testifying today, we'll call on Scott Berry and Brian Doherty. Joel, do you want to come up at the same time? Okay, please proceed. We've got several bills today.
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, members of the committee, again for the record, Joel Lario, Administrator of the Insurance Division within the Department of Consumer and Business Services. I believe I'm here to support, is it 2654 we're on now?
Yes, sir.
I'm here to support 2654. We had this bill in front of the committee a couple times already, I believe, and the issue was a technical one. Everybody agrees that the objective here is to require contractors to have liability coverage that includes completed operations coverage. And so there have been arguments and discussions about exactly how best to express that in statute. I believe the language you have in front of you in the dash twos accomplishes the purpose by talking about products and completed operations according to the terms of the policy and subject to applicable policy exclusions. That's the operative language. I also understand that there's still ongoing concern that that language may mean that the according to the terms of the policy part, the last part of the language, doesn't apply to the whole phrase products and completed operations, and some people, and I think Brian is one of them, maybe the only one, Brian, I'm not sure, think that there ought to be a comma after the word operations. I don't know. I know our intent is to apply that language across the board to products and completed operations, and I'll leave it, I think, to legislative counsel from my perspective to tell us whether a comma there helps or hurts. I can argue it both ways grammatically, and my recommendation, I guess, would be that Bill's been here many times. We could maybe move it over to the Senate, and if legislative counsel can be consulted in the intermediate time, and if there is a need for a comma there, then we can have a comma there on the Senate side. But that would be best I can do today.
Thank you, Mr. Aereo. I've been stumped by less than commas before.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Brian Doherty, representing Contractors Bonding Insurance Corporation. Yes, this is the infamous comma that Representative Bonamici was asking about. It is in two places going after the word operations in the dash two amendments. And I agree. In our law firm, we have a English major that actually teaches our young associates, and she's called Miss Grammar, and Miss Grammar writes us letters and misses all the time about how to write, and I think I can agree with Mr. Hario that there may be subject to interpretation. However, commas have been notoriously famous in some lawsuits, and the purpose really is to make sure that the last phrase after operations applies to the entire section, not that it just applies to completed operations. I'm happy to work with this with legislative counsel over on the Senate side. We are supportive of the bill, and offer that as a suggestion. And we brought it to counsel, but somehow it didn't get to an amendment. I'll be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you. Mr. Berry, wish to say a few words?
Yeah, Scott Berry, the Oregon Home Builders, and also very supportive of the bill, and also with the dash two amendments. Happy to work on the comma struggle over in the Senate as well.
Okay, appreciate your testimony today,
Mr. Chair.
Representative Nelson.
Yes, as an English teacher, I'd just like to tell these gentlemen they don't need a comma.
Thank you.
I'm not going to charge for that.
Thank you. You don't have to be licensed then.
No.
So we have dash twos.
Yes.
I'd like to close the public hearing on House Bill 2654 and open a work session on House Bill 2654.
Mr. Chair, I move that we adopt the dash two amendments to House Bill 2654.
Representative Bonamici moves to adopt the dash two amendments to House Bill 2654. Do I have any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, they are adopted.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2654 as amended with the dash two amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Bonamici moves House Bill 2654 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? May we please have the roll? I don't know her name. Emily, can you please call the roll? He's excused.
Aye.
Having received the required aye votes, House Bill 2654 as amended is passed. And anybody like to volunteer to carry this bill? Representative Riley jumps right up. Thank you very much. You get to carry the bill.
Nobody opposed this one. I'll take it.
With that, I'll close the work session on House Bill 2654. Next up. I'd like to open a public hearing on House Bill 2659. Steve, give us a brief summary of House Bill 2659, please.
Thank you, Chair Holby. House Bill 2659 allows, or at least as originally written, allows the Construction Contractors Board to investigate financial and criminal history of an applicant for licensing. The bill does have a subsequent referral to the Judiciary Committee, and I believe there is someone from the Building Codes Division who can speak about the detailed amendments.
Good afternoon again, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Mark Long with State Building Codes Division and Construction Claims Task Force. House Bill 2659-1, which is what you should have in front of you, is a complete replacement, cut and stuff, set of amendments. You do not need to refer back and forth to the original bill. Everything that we're attempting to do is contained within this particular bill. Again, it's also on our oversheet, which is the package that we've been discussing with the various folks since we last were in front of you several weeks ago. I'll just go into a little bit more detail that isn't provided on the overview sheet about what this bill does. It allows the Construction Contractors Board to investigate applicants for past court judgments, criminal charges, and other administrative orders. Expands information that must be disclosed to CCB. It expands their emergency suspension powers, specifically in the areas of unpaid construction debt. Establishes new enforcement authority for the CCB to issue cease and desist orders and orders of corrective action, specifically for folks who are unlicensed, which they do not have that authority currently. Last time, and I don't have my notes in front of me, but last time we heard this bill, there were several concerns about the criminal citations, some of the criminal background checks. I'm trying to jog our collective memories on this. And we have removed all of the, if you will, pieces of language that were of concern. And my understanding is that there is a conceptual support for the dash one amendments from the various folks in the work group, contractors, agencies, and whatnot that have been working on this bill. So I'll be happy to take any questions that you may have.
Thank you. Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for being back. I had a note handed to me by the legislative director of the ACLU. Mm-hmm. She had to leave the room to go to another hearing, and she wanted to get some assurance that the fingerprint section was taken out. And I'm trying to speed read, but before you leave, I want some confirmation we can pass along. There was a section that permitted either gathering of fingerprints.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bonamici, I think, and I'm going off of my memory, it was in Section 2 of the original bill. And I believe It's the 181.534 reference that's in the original bill, which is Section 2, Subsection 2, Lines 16 through 17. You won't see any reference to 181.534 in this unless we've absolutely made a horrible mistake.
Thank you.
We've taken it out.
Follow up the other... Follow up. And the other section of concern was the section creating criminal citation authority. Is that also deleted from this?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bonamici, yes.
Thank you.
Quick question, Mr. Chair.
Representative Gilliam, question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The shoddy controversy is gone, too, isn't it? Not the shoddy
controversy. I don't know who's chair, but Representative Gilliam, yes.
Vice Chair Nelson.
Vice Chair Nelson, Representative Gilliam. Yes, the shoddy construction piece has been removed as well.
Thank you.
What we attempted to do for the members of the committee is address the concerns that were brought forward. We think we've done that. The ads that were not discussed in the last hearing was, again, the cease and desist and the corrective order ability of the Construction Contractors Board for unlicensed individuals. And we felt that whether you're licensed or unlicensed, they should have equal authority to address problems of those individuals.
Could I just ask about the definition of construction debt? How did we handle that?
We did not change, Mr.
That's all right.
Where's the gavel at? Is it halfway in between?
Halfway. Oh, now he's got it.
Okay. The construction debt is currently defined in CCB law, as I understand it. I'm going to look back to Craig. He's nodding. And we did not change the definition of construction debt with this amendment. So I wish I could recite to you what it is, but I don't have that in front of me. And if you give me a second, I can either look in the books or do you know the definition of construction debt in your chapter law? I think it's in 701.005, isn't it? Yeah.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. While you're looking that up, also mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you about the authority of the CCB to issue criminal citations.
Mm-hmm.
Did we get that out of there? I'm having a hard time catching up on all these.
That's okay. Chair Holby, Representative Nelson, yes, we did.
Okay.
Mr. Chair. Representative Gilliam, a question?
Yes, I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And your very helpful summary that we've referred to, there are two references to this bill.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember... second one, or the issues around the second one, provide additional enforcement authority. Can you just say a word about that?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Representative Gilliam, that's the piece that would allow, one of the issues that came up in work group discussion was CCB's ability to address an unlicensed individual. Obviously, assumingly you have sanctions for licensed individuals. You can revoke, you can fine, etc. My understanding is current law for an unlicensed individual is a misdemeanor, and whether or not they had the ability to fine that individual for working unlicensed was unclear, and the ability to issue a cease and desist and make that contractor take corrective action, even though they're not under their licensing statute, was kind of a void in the CCB law. So that's an additional enforcement authority.
Oh, you have to forgive me. I can't follow up.
Follow up, Representative Gilliam.
I'm very uninformed in this area. Are you saying we do have folks that are allowed under certain conditions to perform construction, but they don't have to be licensed?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gilliam, that is correct, but what we're basically saying is let's say you're required to have a license and you don't for whatever particular unlawful reason. We've expanded the authority of CCB to get at those unlicensed individuals that should have had that license who are acting outside the scope of the license.
One last follow-up.
Which I think is important to all of us.
Follow-up, Representative Gilliam.
So it's just, it kind of closes a loophole. If you're not participating, you somehow think you can't be hunted down. And
Mr. Chair, Representative Gilliam, gives CCB more authority to address those folks who have chosen not to participate for whatever reason. Does not change when and when you do not need a license under current law. I can't articulate that to you off the top of my head.
Okay. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Representative Nelson, another question?
Yes, just one last question. You know, where you we have the authority to suspend a contractor's license because they haven't paid a construction debt or a civil penalty, mm-hmm. that says for the board. But can you tell me where I will find what period of time they have with which in which to do that? Because I can't find it.
Sure. You'll give me just a moment.
Sure.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, you'll find that language on page 11 of the Dash 1 amendments.
Okay.
We already found it.
I was in the other one, so that's why I couldn't find it. Okay.
Oh, you're doing better than I. And it's the new language is set, is bolded in E.
Okay. Okay.
It adds to the list of actions that the board can take, basically without hearing, and it's failure to pay construction debt. And it basically says if you're not fulfilling the performance of that construction debt, which usually when there's a judgment or some kind of award, they specify it's due upon a particular date
right.
or a particular payment schedule.
Right.
If they don't fulfill that after 30 days, then the CCB can take an action.
Okay.
Whatever is contained within that judgment.
It did get in there. Okay.
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you, Mark. I see no further questions of you this time. I appreciate you coming forward. And, you know, I don't know if Craig wanted to comment on this bill or not. Thank you. That's a no. I have up John O'Shell who wanted to say something about the bill. Next on the list.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, John O'Shell, Association of Oregon Counties. Just to let you know, we support the Dash amendments, including the fact that we support the dropping of shoddy workmanship and the citations based on that shoddy workmanship. We greatly appreciate the ability for the investigation for the Construction Contractors Board, because that's where we go to use our determinations, to get information for our determination of the lowest responsible bidder after bid opening. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for that. Any questions, Mr. O'Shell? Appreciate you coming forward. With that, committee, I'm going to close. Is there anybody else that wanted to testify on House Bill 2659? I'm going to close public hearing on House Bill 2659, and I'm not going to be working that bill today. With that, I would like to open a hearing on House Bill 2656. Can you give us a brief summary of that bill, please?
Thank you, Chair Holvey. House Bill 2656 establishes a certification training for building envelope specialists and building envelope installers and also establishes continuing education requirements for people who work on building envelopes.
Thank you.
Oh, and there are Dash 1 and Dash 2 amendments before the committee.
Thank you. Mr. Long, would you like to come up and just give us a jog our memory a little bit and maybe real briefly describe the amendments? I'm sure you can describe all of those real briefly.
Chair, members of the committee, for the record again, Mark Long with State Building Codes. 2656 is again listed on our overview. This is the what I would call the certification of the competency standards for contractors working on envelopes. The consensus document that we're bringing forward to you are the Dash 1 amendments. What this bill does is provide for contractors must designate an individual who is working on a building envelope to have a certification. We broke the certifications down by three categories, roughly roof, walls, windows, doors, and then the custom exterior finishes. Contractor also has to have either the same individual or it could be a separate individual verify that work through a checklist that's submitted to the local building department indicating that the envelope piece that they worked on in which they're appropriately certified for is installed properly. This bill also
allows the Construction Contractors Board to establish all the rules and regulations around these certified individuals and the trained providers through rulemaking effort, and we establish a committee in statute to make sure we have adequate representation to help with the rulemaking. And then a second piece of this bill is required continuing education for all contractors that are licensed by the CCB. This bill is different from the original bill that was submitted, and you received quite a bit of testimony on this, in that there was a two-tiered certification system, and this is a single-tiered certification system. And if you want to visualize with me, contractors on the job site, let's say they're a roofing contractor, we'll try to make it simple. They'll have to have one person on their staff or contract with somebody to do the work to actually install that roofing material, if you will, that is appropriately certified through this administrative rulemaking process that we'll go through the Construction Contractors Board. At the conclusion of that roofing effort, there needs to be a checklist completed either by that certified individual that was on that job site working for that subcontractor or contractor, or you could bring in a third party if you so choose. We allow the contractors that flexibility. We've heard that some of the contractors in the commercial area want to do that, and that list is turned into the building department. We've provided oversight and enforcement authority for CCB to address these certified individuals and the contractors that fail to provide for that checklist or fail to use a properly certified individual. I think that's about it. This, we've clarified, Mr. Chair, that this applies to the installation of decks. You heard testimony about that last time. If you pierce the envelope of a structure, you'll have to have the certification. And we've provided an exemption for the manufactured housing industry when they're operating under the federal exemption that they currently have. So with that, I'd be happy to take any questions that you have. And by the way, the dash one is a complete replacement of the bill. So you only need to look at the language in the dash one amendments that we have proposed to you.
Representative Nelson.
Yes, thank you. Mr. Chair, Mark, why don't y'all go to the word appropriate versus certified?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, because there's three different types of certification, depending on whether you work on the roof or the walls or the windows or the doors or you do custom exterior finishes, it's which one is appropriate is based on the work that you do. We didn't want to create a one-size-fits-all, recognizing that some of the contractors only do roofs, and we need to have training and certification only for the roof subcontractor. Some contractors only do walls. So the appropriate one would be for the work that they're doing. We couldn't just list and because...
Okay, but it's still... Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Mm-hmm.
It's still an appropriate certified building envelope specialist.
Correct.
Whatever area they're working on, they still have to be certified.
They have to be certified, and they have to have the appropriate one, which is under the scope of work we've identified.
The scope of work.
Exactly.
Okay.
And we've broken it down into three. Sorry, Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson. We broke it down into the three categories, as I've mentioned.
But we didn't take certified out of there, did we? Excuse me. Mm-hmm. I mean, somewhere in this bill, they still have to be certified.
Yes.
Okay.
Representative Gilliam. Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you point me to the spot in the bill where it says that a certified individual has to be on site?
Mr. Chair, Representative Riley, and we had that comment in our last hearing, and I believe I've accomplished that. It's in Section 2. And if you give me just a second. Section 2 on the first page. I just want to make sure I understand. For each structure in which a contractor performs building envelope work, the contractor shall designate at least one appropriate, depending on the work they do, specialist for each type of building envelope in the work the contractor performs. The language that we had in front of you, the kind of work in progress, did not have that designation that they need to have at least one on the job site for the appropriate type. Did I get it wrong again?
I don't read this to say that they have to be on the job site. have to designate one, but it doesn't say where he has to be. It could be in an office.
Mr. Chair, Representative Riley, we're not intending to do that, obviously, and we understood in working with the work group that there will be one designated and on site to actually physically do the work. And I think what we've done, if you give me just a second, is we've defined building envelope work later on in the bill as the trigger point for that. Qualifications. Okay, I'm going off of memory here. Page 9, we defined building envelope work means the actual work itself, and that is a new definition that we put in to make sure that we're triggering for each structure which a contractor performs building envelope work, they have to designate at least one appropriate specialist. Building envelope work means the construction, reconstruction, alteration, repair, building envelope of a structure. It does not have the site piece, but you can hopefully see the... You're shaking your head. You can see what our intent was.
Read, I do not read anywhere in here that it has to be on site.
Okay.
And I can't,
you want me to
I, can't
that
make, I can't make that stretch personally.
Nor can I.
Well, certified I've got, but on site I don't.
Mr. Chair, there's not a disagreement with the position or the policy. We believe we'd accomplished it with the language, but maybe we haven't. And we've discussed it with the work group, and I don't think there's an issue of disagreement on this matter.
Well, I'll take your word for that, but the court won't.
Certainly, I appreciate that comment, Representative Riley. I know it was the intention of the work group to accomplish an on-site person, but I, for the life of me, can't see it in here either. And, you know, we kind of moved back from having 100% of the people that are installing the product being certified to just at least having one. And we want to make sure we get that one, I think, in this group. So, with that, any other questions for Mr. Long? Appreciate your work on this. Looks like we may have just a little bit more work to do on this one.
That being the case, I want to make one more comment, Mr. Chair.
A quick comment, because I do have some other people that need to talk.
Is this bill an appropriate place to consider putting in the practical part of the stucco, of the stucco product, in the training bill?
It's in here, Mr. Chair.
It's already in. It is included in
this. Okay, okay.
And we have a separate classification for that type of work. It's one of the appropriate certified.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Long. I'm going to go ahead and relieve you of your
I'm going to keep reading
seat here and move on to another testifier. Larry White, again, please. Yes, for the record, state your name. I don't know if I had you do that last time. Okay. I thought I did.
Chair Holvey, Vice Chair Bonamici, Vice Chair Nelson, and members of the committee. My name is Larry White. I'm the Plaster Division Manager for Western Partitions, an Oregon-based large commercial subcontractor specializing in drywall, steel studs, plaster, acoustical ceilings, and fireproofing. I have 27 years experience in the construction industry as a plasterer, foreman, superintendent, project manager. 4 years ago, when I was put in charge of the plaster division at Western Partitions, one of my first tasks was implementing our building envelope quality assurance program. One of the problems that we addressed is building envelopes have become more complicated, and all the components have to be installed properly to work together. These components are usually installed by different subcontractors. Weatherproof membrane is covered by an exterior cladding such as brick, plaster, and wood. If one of the components of the weatherproof membrane is installed incorrectly and covered by the other subcontractors and eventually fails, the consumer, the contractor, and all the subcontractors may end up in a lawsuit. Western Partitions has a no-cover policy, which means our employees are trained to identify problems and get them corrected before they cover inadequate work. Currently, many contractors have employees that are not sufficiently trained in building envelope, and when a building envelope fails, the whole industry gets blamed.
I believe the only way to solve this is to include the 100% application certification in House Bill 2056, so that all workers on the project will understand how all the components work together within the building envelope. The problem that House Bill 2656 will solve is that all contractors and subcontractors will be held to the same standard of training and proficiency, and consumers will get quality projects that they are paying for. Over the last 4 years, I have seen a rise in so-called billing envelope specialists. For each new specialist, I see a different theory of design, many of what I would term a hybrid with no testing or history of longevity. Contractors and consumers have to trust these designs without the knowledge that these specialists have any formalized training or certification. I've been witness to numerous occasions where building envelope specialists have inspected and passed substandard work that at times has not even met building code requirements. This leads me to believe that many of them are not properly trained and qualified. Proper training and certification of these building envelope specialists is the only way to protect consumers and the construction industry. House Bill 2656 will be a large step forward to improving a standard of quality that will protect consumers, eliminate construction defects, and reduce the current level of chaos found in our industry today. I am supportive of the passage of this House bill and believe that 100% applicator certification should be re-included in the bill. I would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. White, for coming forward with that testimony. And I'm just sort of curious, I guess, you know, we've tried to listen to the industry somewhat on this bill, and it was mostly the industry that came forward and said, you know, frankly, I don't see how we can certify our entire industry. It sounds like your company is entirely certified for the people that install these products, but I'm just kind of curious, do you really think we have the capacity to certify the entire residential and commercial industry in the state of Oregon? And short of that, do you think it would work? I guess our current proposal is, you know, that we have one person that's actually involved in the installation on each structure this work's being performed on, that's been trained and certified to this, and that they hopefully have a similar no cover policy as you call it is really my goal, because our building officials don't get up on roofs anymore, especially in the residential area, just liability reasons and safety reasons, and very difficult for them to check the nailing, for example, which I believe is one of the major problems we face with failures, is that they're covering up in substandard work and then putting an envelope over the top of it. So I guess the long-winded question is, if we, granted, you're saying 100% is really where we need to be, but we need to take a step at getting there. So do you think it's reasonable for us to ask for one person to be certified, and do you think that is enough to ensure that the job gets done properly if there's one guy on the job, or one woman or person or whoever that specialist may be, to, you know, basically participate in the installation and make sure it's getting done right? Does that work?
Chair Holvey, I believe that, one, the more eyes you have, they're qualified looking at it. Some of these large projects, and, you know, on a house, one set of eyes may be enough, but, you know, we did Bridgeport Village, 300,000 square feet of plaster. One eye wasn't enough. You know, I needed all my people. And the AWCI has actually an EAFS training program, and they require you to be AWCI certified to have a percentage of your crew. So maybe it is a percentage. Maybe it's your lead man, and we need to look at it that way. And eventually, I would like to see everybody. I would like to think all my guys know what they're looking for and what they're doing. And we've kind of taken this on our own, and our training and the program that I developed was something that it's kind of self-evolving, if you will, and we've been doing, changes to it, trying to make it better in-house, because it's important for us. We don't want to be in a lawsuit. We don't want to have construction defects, and I've made it a point to the owner of my company that I'm going to do everything I can to avoid that. But I'd like to see all the other contractors doing it. I'm going to costs and expenses And then I get underbid by a guy that doesn't have qualified people, you know, and then their job fails, but it's just another failed plaster job. You know, I get lumped in with that. When architects and owners don't want to use my product anymore, I'm out of business. And I think a responsible contractor should already be doing this, and a lot of them are, but I think we just need to pull everybody in and get, you know, get to the point where we don't have the irresponsible contractors out there doing bad houses and having problems. I think we can get there. And, you know, I actually have an example. We're doing Cascade Station out by the airport, and my guys, the flashing subcontractor, was doing a saddle flashing. He wasn't working for us. He's working for the general, and my guy's coming next, and they're going to put the vapor barrier over his flashing, and it was inadequate. It was going to fail. And my guy on the crew, he was able to identify it. He called our superintendent. They came out. We did digital pictures. We met with the general contractor. We saw what needed to be repaired, and we fixed it. You know, once we cover it up, that flashing thing, everybody's going to say, well, the plaster leaks. Well, if it's the flashing, the leaking, and I didn't, you know, we've got to protect that, and we've got to get to that point in our industry.
Thank you for that, and I don't know if you had time to look at those other amendments about the EFIS or not. Do you think that really substantially impacts your industry?
Well, I think the way that's written, it does.
Okay. A little off the subject, but thank you for your testimony. We're going to have to go ahead and close this hearing. I appreciate you coming, traveling down here, and giving us your testimony on this, Phil. Appreciate it.
Chair, very quickly before you close this hearing.
Real quick.
So my understanding that the manufactured housing folks do not any longer want to be excluded from this. Have you?
I've had that discussion, and we'll have another opportunity.
Thank you.
And it looks like we may need an amendment to this bill. And,
Thank you.
I'm going to work with
Was that quick enough for you?
Mr. Long and stuff on that. You bet. It was quick. My answer was probably longer than your question. Folks, I'm real sorry we didn't get through our agenda quite almost. We will be carrying these bills over that we didn't move today to or here today, 2656, 2657, 2659, and 2871 to Monday.
2110
also. We may carry that one over too. I'm not sure.
So we're not, no session, no committee on Friday.
Yes, we do have a committee on Friday.
Oh. With that, I'd like to close the committee on consumer protection.